am every patient. Every patient is going to think about mortality, about dying, and how does one cope with the anxiety that one experiences.
Coming up on In Contrasts, Fighting Cancer with Peter Rooney. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Peter Rooney is an award-winning journalist. He is the author of Immunopatient, a memoir about his own ordeal through cutting-edge treatments in cancer immunotherapy, the researchers behind it, the doctors who provide it, and the patients who look for hope in its cure. Welcome to In Contrast, Peter Rooney. It's a pleasure to have you here. Let me start by giving a little context to the narrative that you offer in your book, Immunopatient. Early in 2011, while driving in the morning from New Hampshire to Massachusetts, from your home to where you worked, you had a little, what looked like insignificant accident in the car. The car just slipped on the ice. It was winter, and you hurt one of your shoulders. Thinking that it wasn't anything serious, you first continued with your regular routine. Eventually, you went to the doctor and found out that you had stage 4 kidney cancer. What goes back to that moment, the moment when you received the news?
Well, first, thank you, Ilan, for having me on. And the drive to do the interview with you was triggering some of those memories and really didn't take much time to elapse before I found the news that was delivered to me in your typical doctor's office, patients waiting, reading magazines. And then I was brought in to a consult room. And Dr. Richard Wu told me, after having seen images that showed a large bone lesion in my left humerus, that there was something definitely wrong, that it was cancer of some sort. And they sent me to do a full body scan, and a large tumor was seen in my right kidney. And when you're given news like that, I remember just being stunned and floored, and almost like a rush of overwhelming my senses, my brain. Didn't last for terribly long. And then I think some sort of survival instinct started to kick in for me, where I went into kind of a reflexive questioning mode, maybe reflecting my background as a reporter or a journalist. So I started getting very focused on asking about what this really meant, what my prospects for survival were, where do we go from here? And I think those questions were kind of masking this deep dread that at the same time was beginning to form in the pit of my stomach, as they say. And I remember also thinking that my wife, Katerina, needs to be in on this conversation. So I was able to use my cell phone to patch her in, put her on speakerphone so she could kind of hear and absorb this information, because I knew from the outset that, as if our lives weren't challenging enough, and everybody has stressful lives, everybody suffers, but we were in for some more stress and some more suffering.
You were a healthy, athletic man in his late 40s, and that questioning mode that you talk about, the reporter in you, the journalist, kicked in automatically. And what happens from then to the present is a narrative that you have given us, Immunopatient. I want to talk to you about how, as you were going through the ordeal of finding details about your illness, the challenges, the many operations, the relationship with your wife and with your two children, you were also focused on gathering all this information and eventually shaping it in the form of a book. Did the act of writing become therapeutic along the way? Did it intrude in the way you were connecting with the illness? Did it actually help in understanding the illness better?
I would say yes to all three aspects of your question. It was therapeutic, it was an intrusion, and it did lead to answers for me as a patient that I don't think I would have uncovered had I not also been using my journalistic background, in a sense, acting as a reporter, maybe stepping into the character or the role of reporter to shield myself in some ways from being a patient, but also think I was playing a psychological trick on myself, because the role of the reporter in our society, it's a much maligned role. But one thing that I always enjoyed about it was it essentially gave me kind of permission or a ticket to attend events, to knock on doors, to track down people that as a private citizen, you don't really have that opportunity. So it helped me be a better patient. But there were also times when the information that I was receiving or the news I had to absorb, bad news, was so overwhelming and deeply personal that it did feel like an intrusion to write about it. So it took me time. But I think ultimately, as I worked through, and you know, as a writer, I know the more honest you can be about your fears, anxieties, your innermost thoughts, kind of inner existence that we all lead with, concerns, flitting thoughts, certainly thoughts about death and dying. Stage 4 cancer is no joke. But I think ultimately I did find that it helped me absorb and ultimately come to grips and accept my situation as a cancer patient in a way that provided me with some hope for the future and also acceptance for no matter what my situation prognosis was, is, or will be, that I think I've come to accept it without giving up or throwing in the towel.
The reporter's task is to identify a story, and the story slowly unfolds as the mind enters various doors that allow that reporter to understand the architecture of that story. In your case, the story is you. That is a very raw and immediate aspect of your book. Did you write it for self-satisfaction or self-therapeutic elements? Is there something here that you're hoping as well that it would serve the medical profession, the administrators, the other patients in figuring out what the inside story is, how a patient goes through all the entire journey?
Certainly the book would have limited value or interest if it was just about me, in my opinion. So I'm trying to be honest about my motivations, and I think by nature, people tend to be self-centered. So I do think that I thought about myself first and whether writing the book would help me. But close behind that was the thought that for a book to find an audience, for an editor to deem it to be relevant, it needs to be interesting and useful and important and hopefully helpful to a broader range of people, to a larger audience. And indeed, that was my goal in writing this book, was to share the information from a kind of wide-eyed, slightly skeptical, optimistic but not delusionally so patient who's navigating a medical system can be very daunting and frightening when you're talking about big city, big research medicine and driving in to appointments, visiting people at some of these iconic institutions like Dana-Farber. So I try to, in a sense, offer a guide to someone who might be going through that intensely frightening experience. And I hope that being honest and open about my own situation demonstrates and reveals that, to a certain extent, I am every patient. Every patient is going to think about mortality, about dying, and how does one cope with the anxiety that one experiences when every 3 months you're being scanned, and every scan can bring either good news or bad news. What I additionally sought to do, I was fortunate enough to be under the treatment and care of some research medical doctors so they see patients, but they're also conducting research. They're kind of on the front lines of working with the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry to test whether these new generations of cancer treatments, which are based on your own body's ability to use your immune system and specifically the white blood cells in your immune system, and even more specifically, a type of white blood cell called a T cell to track down and kill cancer cells. So, you know, you're part of something bigger in that, and I wanted to a certain extent, demystify also the clinical trial process, because I think in this new era of cancer treatment that we find ourselves in, there are a very promising number of immune therapy treatments that are either undergoing trials right now or looming on the horizon, and patients should consider participating in them after, of course, carefully evaluating them and making sure that they are kind of overlapping with their own situation.
Can I ask you about the treatment itself, the conventional therapies that were available, and what the immunotherapy in itself entailed?
Basically, once I was diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer, they also determined that it had not only spread to a significant degree to my left upper arm, but also right above the knee was a spot. So the initial treatment was to actually do surgery to remove the right kidney to keep it from spreading further tumors through the blood in the rest of my body, and then also to stabilize my left upper arm with a titanium rod. After I recovered from that surgery for about 2 weeks, I then underwent radiation. Chemotherapy does not work with kidney cancer. It's categorized as a blood cancer, and chemotherapy is really good at tumors that can be contained, but if they can be kind of seeded through the blood, they don't work that well. So my treatment options were rather limited. After that surgery, it was watch and wait for about a year. And then I went in for a series of scans with a sense of foreboding, because the doctor usually called me and told me everything looks good, and he hadn't called me. So when I went to that appointment with my wife, we were a little nervous. He told us at that time that there were numerous tumors that had been detected in my two lungs and in numerous lymph nodes. And at that point, he essentially handed the baton over to Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, where I underwent a kind of early form of immunotherapy that is called HDIL-2 treatment. It essentially revs up your immune system. You're in an intensive care unit for a week, then they send you home for a week to recover, and then you come back for another week. During that time, they're trying to get as many white blood cell antibodies in you to rev up your immune system to kill the cancer cells. It also makes you very sick. Some people describe it as the worst flu you've ever had times three. And then you go home and you come back in about 6 weeks and they scan you and see if it has worked. It actually, in my case, did not work. It works in about 20% of the people who take it. In 8 or 9% of those, it's actually curative. Then about another year passed, and they kept scanning me, and maybe this immunotherapy and maybe my visualization bought me some time, because nothing was really growing very fast, at least. But after about a year, things started growing again, and it was at that point that they recommended I consider enlisting in a clinical trial that combined two immunotherapy treatments. It was what would be called a phase one clinical trial. There's three phases for a drug to receive FDA approval. So this was an early stage, first time these two agents had been tested in humans in combination. One of them was FDA approved already as a single agent, and the other was in phase three. So our consideration when evaluating this offer for a clinical trial was to take all those factors into account and then essentially say, yeah, roll the dice, let's do it, because the other options didn't look that promising. They involve pretty bad side effects. So then I would receive treatment every 2 weeks, and those two were combined for the first 3 months, and then after 3 months, it was just one treatment. And within about 3 months, I think I was scanned once after 8 weeks, and there was progression. Things were growing. We were all very worried, but we were told, settle down. we've done this enough to know that this can happen. There can be some initial inflammation and then shrinkage. Then what happened the next time was that there was actually 50% shrinkage in all of these tumors. That was probably the first really solid good news that we had received in more than 2 years of dealing with cancer.
At one point, there were also growths in your brain.
Yeah, and that brings up another interesting kind of scientific question, and that's the extent to which the immune system is active in the brain. And my hope, and indeed some research backs this up, that there is immune system activity in the brain, but not as much as in the rest of the body. There's a blood-brain barrier that stops a lot of the white blood cells from getting up there, because as one doctor pointed out, if your immune system could have total free access to your brain, then your brain would probably swell up because some sort of infection would get up there and you'd die. So it's actually a good thing we don't have total immune system penetration in the brain. But I have been treated with what they call a cyber knife. That's the brand name. It's high dosage, very tightly focused radiation to essentially zap about 5 very small brain tumors that they've identified. And they're optimistic that as long as I'm regularly scanned, if any more come up, and, you know, I'm hoping that these were all seeded before my immunotherapy, if any do come up in the future, that they can continue to be treated that way.
Throughout the book, there is a kind of parallel dialogue. You enter a doctor's office or a hospital, or you undergo surgery, you find out information online and elsewhere, and all that is delivered in a straightforward, almost a scientific way, very objective, very impartial. And then there is this parallel line of offering certain thoughts that you have that appear in italicized. When a doctor tells you that he's not sure of something, you express the doubt to yourself. We're allowed to enter your mind and see, well, this wasn't very comforting, or does he know enough about what is happening, or am I going to be a guinea pig on all this? In that window humanizes the whole experience. Tell me more about that aspect of the narrative, of opening that window.
Thank you for noticing that. And I think that might represent for me a little bit of an evolution as a transitioning maybe from a pure reporter journalist with a background in daily journalism, kind of a just the facts approach, to challenging myself to become a writer who can really better serve the reader by being a character in the narrative. So it's not just this detached, authoritative voice that can become kind of boring, frankly, in journalism stories, but, you know, is necessary, I suppose. So it's more personal in this way that it is a first-person account. I call it a reported memoir, but it is a memoir. And for someone who never considered himself to be particularly self-reflective or navel-gazing, memoirs can be sometimes that way. And I try not to go too far in that direction, but nevertheless, I think I reveal enough of myself and, you know, fairly honest in conveying my thoughts, my disappointments sometimes, or sometimes just incidents that happen in all of our lives where we kind of shake our head because there's something maybe a little absurd about the situation, but something we just kind of observe, and in my case, note, and then kind of keep going.
You say that you were not, prior to all this medical, spiritual ordeal that you've been going through, you were not particularly self-reflecting. I wonder if you can tell me how you have changed, not only physically, you mention it in great detail in the book, the pains that you suffer, the discomfort, the fact that you can't do certain exercises, that you get very tired, that you have headaches, but more psychologically and even spiritually, what is the difference between the Peter prior to that accident in 2011 and the Peter that sees the book already completed? Has it changed you fundamentally, or have you resisted that change?
Boy, putting Peter on the couch is not something that I engage in too often, but how could stage 4 cancer not change someone? What it has told me about myself is that I have a relatively high threshold for physical pain. And I think how this experience has changed me is that I have become more accepting of my situation. I've become more appreciative of the time that I am able to live, because everybody's going to die. But when you have stage 4 cancer, even if things are going relatively well, my own personal experience has told me that bad news can come at any time. So enjoying life, being in the moment, and slowing down, and just trying, at least setting a goal, to really treasure interactions with people that you encounter, and not look ahead to the next thing, but just focus on the here and now, and appreciate that, you know, you're doing pretty well, and you're living in a time of great advances in medicine, and you're still able to do what you do. There are a lot of phrases that come to mind, like, don't worry, be happy, go with the flow, breathe. I think all of these sentiments are sentiments that would not have occurred to me as much 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But they come to mind a lot more now as mantras that help me at least live my life and find this balance and equanimity at a time when I know that my situation can really change. So I think that's kind of how I've changed, if that makes any sense.
Throughout the book, you face the way the medical profession turns all of us when we enter hospitals, when we enter doctor's offices, into patients. We become statistics, we become bodies that are looked at. At various points in the book, you do exactly what you were talking about just a minute ago. You slow down, you take it easy, you become conscious of breathing in and breathing out, the way your body can bend or doesn't bend. And you also allow us readers to understand the struggle that is going on in your mind. You want to stop certain thoughts. You are very conscious that if you stop those certain thoughts, you might also be able to stop the growth of tumors in other malignant entities in your body. And there is in the book this sense that the mind can help control the illness that you have, or at least a suggestion that you make to yourself that this is not only a battle that is being fought in the cells, in the molecules, in your organs, but it is a battle that is being fought in your mind. Tell me more about that.
Well, one of the themes or one of the things that I was very curious and interested in finding out more about is the extent to which a positive mental attitude can affect outcomes, and the extent to which things like prayer, meditation, guided imagery, visualization could help enlist and help boost the immune system, essentially. There's a quest in there to explore whether the mind can be harnessed to fight the disease that's ravaging the body. And so this was a question that I would ask pretty much everyone that I encountered, from the traditionally educated and trained physicians to the neurologists, oncologists. An old friend of mine who's a PhD chemist from Harvard, who then worked for the biotech industry, to people who were from the world of meditation, and also a cancer patient from Texas who came down with stage 4 cancer when the treatment prospects were very bleak in the 90s, and took it upon himself to research this question as well, and wrote a book and developed a series of guided imagery CDs that were in part grounded in research. What I was trying to do also was to evaluate some of these claims, kind of using my rational side, and found that indeed there is research that backs up the notion of, for example, the placebo effect. Everyone knows about the fact that a rather sizable percentage of people who are given placebo pills, which are sugar pills essentially, and not told that's what they are, but are under the impression that they are medically therapeutic will actually improve. There's an underlying question in there of how can one harness the mind to fight disease in the body? And I don't think I was able to be the person who definitively proves that this is all effective. But in my own situation, I think it helped me. If nothing else, I was able to get a good night's sleep and feel that my mind is doing something. And, you know, I've had enough positive results to suggest that, well, maybe it played a role.
And yet lurking always in the background as you present yourself in the battle that you are engaging in against kidney cancer and its side effects is the frustration and the anger and the disappointment that you don't want to submit to. But these are constant emotions that are present. They are in your book like on the margins of it. You don't want to be angry at what is happening, it seems to the reader. You don't want to be frustrated. You don't want to feel like a guinea pig. You want to feel that you have to turn the tide on your side and that you might be riding the wave of a much more hopeful research period than anybody that has come before. How does one battle the anger that comes at the feeling, Peter, that your life is being cut short?
Well, I think I'm thankful for the life that I have had. So the anger for me, I'm not going to say it doesn't come, but if it comes, then I am able to control it relatively quickly. And I have to say, I wouldn't be able to do that were it not for the support of my wife, Katerina, and my two sons, Max and Jacob, and a support system of friends and relatives who are there for me and who I feel like I'm there for them as well. And they're depending on me to be strong. And I'm not always strong, but I feel that if I can't do it for myself, sometimes I tell myself, well, do it for them. So I think that helps me.
You talk particularly at the end of the book of cancer as a beast, you and other patients, a beast, a monster. You don't explain in the book particularly why you and others describe it that way. I have seen in the medical profession and among patients and friends and relatives descriptions of cancer that vary. Some of them are more poetic, others are much more factual. To me, a beast is a very concrete image. Describe to me what cancer is for you. What kind of beast is this?
Cancer to me is a crafty beast, very wily, but also very dumb. Because if you think about it, why would this beast set up in the human body and ensure its own destruction and death by consuming cells and then organs within the host? To me, is a stupid beast that can be vanquished and slowly is being vanquished through the iconic ways that beasts get vanquished in stories, you know, trickery, cunning, courage, combat, all these methods. And I see a lot of modern and the immunotherapy is maybe a new front in that battle against the beast. I will say there are, I won't say competing narratives or metaphors, but complementary, or just because I have this image in my mind, that doesn't work for everyone. Some people see cancer, and research supports this, as almost a symbiotic thing that is going on in everyone, that by the time one is diagnosed with a sort of cancer, it's a manifestation of something that finally come to the surface through imaging that has been going on for a long time. And there are a lot of low-level cancerous cells, too small to be counted, minute probably in everybody, but the T cells and the immune system is doing its job and is kind of nipping these cancer cells in the bud. And so there's also, a metaphor of a harmonious coexistence, might be too peaceful of an image, but of some sort of coexistence that can occur in individuals. And I think indeed that might be a new metaphor or a hope down the road that, well, if for me, let's say in my situation, and I think I kind of am representative of people who can't claim to be cured by cancer, but can claim to be managing or taming the cancer beast through treatment and through regular scans and also just buying time, to use another metaphor, and staying around long enough for new treatments to be developed.
Because at the very end of the book, there is a very insightful dialogue that you have with one of your doctors where the two of you talk about curing cancer. And the gist of that dialogue is that one has to understand what one means by cure. Is cure the elimination of the cancer? Or as you are mentioning right now, is the capacity to buy time, to postpone the end of making life livable with the illness while not eradicating it altogether? Cure seems to be the leitmotif in the book, in the recognition that it changes, the meaning of it changes, that by the end of the book, you realize that you're not going to get rid of this beast, that in some ways the beast is going to be always there in one way or another, but that you are taming it in order to live a balanced and a happy life within the constraints of that battle. Is that the vision that you have made peace with? The book ends about maybe a year from the dialogue that you and I are having right now. Is that still something that is very much with you?
I think that's a good way to put it. It's an acceptance of the situation of immunotherapy as a very promising treatment and one that represents perhaps a watershed moment in the treatment of cancer. But it is also in its early stages, and it's important not to overhype the promise. The response rates for some of the new immunotherapies are still only in the 25% to 35% range. So I think the next horizon of immunotherapy research and treatment is to think and research, why is it the response rates are so low, and what can we do to improve the response rates? And other questions are around the side effects of immunotherapy. So immunotherapy conceptually, as it works now, and I interview Gordon Freeman at length, whose basic research led to this, and he had kind of a contrarian approach in his research, where other people were interested in understanding what revs up the immune system. He focused on, how does the immune system stand down after fighting an infection? What is the exact biomechanical process by which that happens? And he essentially was able to discover not only where the brakes on the immune system reside, but how to override those brakes. And so his new immunotherapy treatments are based on the concept of overriding the brakes on the immune system to give the T cells enough time to track down and kill the cancer cells. Now, when your immune system is revved up like that, it can also get curious about other things going on in your body and trigger side effects or autoimmune reactions. So some of the side effects from immunotherapy include things like colitis, which is a pretty nasty digestive problem. In my case, after almost 3 years of being on this clinical trial, I developed an autoimmune arthritis pretty seriously. And so that's happened since the book came out. I give a nod to it in my epilogue. So I do think, going back to your original question, this notion of a cure is still the holy grail that's out there, because the fact is that in a small percentage of people who take immunotherapy, it actually is curative, like maybe 8 or 9%. So everybody has a little bit of the Las Vegas casino player in them and thinks, well, why not me? Why can't I be in those 10%? People win the lottery every day. So I think that notion of having that hope for the big cure is definitely one that the immunotherapy story holds out hope for. But I think it also holds out hope and inspiration, hopefully, for that kind of broad swath of 25, 30, 40, 50, hopefully 60, 70% of people who get a decent response, some shrinkage or stability. They're able to buy time at a good quality of life for several years, spend time with their children, watch their children grow up, witness some milestones like graduation, marriage, grandkids, all those things that make a rich and vibrant life that I hope my book shows a path for leading a life while you may have the scepter of having to live with cancer, that there is always something new in the pipeline. So it's actually a very hopeful time. As one of my doctors said, it's unlucky that you have stage 4 cancer, but you are lucky to be having it at a time like this.
It seems from the book that you have had really insightful, informative, provocative, sustaining conversations about a lot of things, including empathy with the medical profession, that you have been lucky, as Dr. Friedman told you, for being able to handle the situation that you have at this particular time, but also because you have found people like him and others. We live at a time where there's a lot of upheaval connected with the healthcare system in the United States, and the political establishment either wants to push it in one direction or in the other. Health insurance companies are fighting for their space. Patients are looking at things from another perspective. You navigate this in a very kind of impartial, direct way. I wonder if you can give us a view of what it is that you take from this particular moment in the health system.
Well, if I'm very honest, I feel like probably so many others in this country that I'm walking on a financial tightrope. So my own personal situation is that I feel, first of all, I acknowledge my privilege. When I was diagnosed, I had excellent health care coverage, and I started with local and regional providers and soon received referrals to Boston, where, again, I was fortunate enough to have access to some of the best oncologists and surgeons in the world. So I'm very fortunate to have been able to access that level of care. And there's no denying that the quality of that care is very high. The challenge, of course, is to broaden that access so everyone can benefit. And there are so many disparities. We are facing pretty daunting healthcare costs. Knock on wood, have thus far been able to escape what some people have called the financial toxicity of people who have cancer. There's a lot of research that shows that bankruptcy rates of patients with cancer are many times the national level. People lose jobs because of cancer or can't find new ones. So you're exposed not only to your medical condition, but you're exposed to financial upheaval. And, you know, you find out that the social safety net doesn't appear to be that strong. And the fear is that it's just fraying around the edges and in the center, and that more and more people will be falling through it.
Peter, I want to bring you to the last topic of our conversation, and that is the topic of death. You mentioned it at the beginning, and it's also another very big presence in the book. We are not a culture that likes to talk about death. We're a culture that hides death, that covers it in blankets and disappears it very quickly. We battle death as if it was an end. We don't see any continuity beyond it. And we also are ashamed of it. As you were saying, all of us will die. The difference with a patient like you is that you have it looming over you in a constant way. What does it mean to you? What kind of relationship you have with it? Would you name it?
Well, I suppose I'm a pretty accurate reflection of the culture you were mentioning that doesn't like to think about death or talk about it. Obviously, for my book, I addressed it, but probably fair to say not in as much detail. So it's not a memoir about facing my own mortality. I think I have more work to do on that. I guess for me, it's not looming in the forefront, but it's in my mind or consciousness more than I'm sure it is for most other people who are 53 and in good health. So I think I'm in a little bit of a state of denial about my own mortality still. But at the same time, I'm not getting too worked up about it. If the things that I am trying to do to find some accommodation with cancer and if not cure it, at least keep it at bay and buy time. If something happens in my body or in the cancer so it begins to grow aggressively, I'm not going to pursue every last cure option or subject myself to pain and discomfort. I will accept what's in store for me, and I feel like I have a relationship with the concept of death and an understanding and acceptance of it that doesn't mean that I welcome it, but I think I'm getting to the point where I don't fear it.
I want to thank you for coming to In Contrast. I want to thank you for the courage to write Immunopatient, the book about your journey. I want to thank you for becoming a mirror and a model of what this type of journey entails and for turning it into a narrative. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really treasure the time that I've had to speak to you about it, Ilan.
Thank you. In the United States, we don't like to talk about death. We see it as an unwelcome visitor. We despise it. We fear it. We postpone it. Other cultures are less stringent. They look at death with benign eyes, not as an end, but as a continuation. Of course, anyone who loves life wants death not to rush, but to take its time. Illness is the battlefield where death is fought. Science offers an assortment of tools for that fight. Arguably, one of the fiercest enemies is cancer. We use all sorts of metaphors to describe it. The beast is one I have heard frequently. Describing it that way turns it into a creature of horror, a menacing entity capable of destruction. But cancer is also a self-destructive monster because its strategy in the battlefield is about killing the very sources that allow it to exist. In other words, the triumph of cancer is also its own death. Stories of cancer patients are often wrenching affairs. We know that it might be us who the beast will face next time around. It is therefore important to learn as much as possible about how to cope with the disease. Learning, however, won't cancel the possibility of its arrival. It will simply allow us to be prepared, whatever that means. Some memoirs about cancer are about the rawness of emotions spilled all around among family, close friends, and acquaintances. Others are about the need to resist. One might resist seeing oneself as a patient, a fact that often results in the dehumanization of the person, because that would give cancer the upper hand, and it would allow death to have an easier landing. Yet another strategy is to inform oneself fully about whatever new treatment is around and maybe allow oneself to serve as a guinea pig in the exploration of a new cure. I don't like the term guinea pig because it makes the patient seem dispensable. Yet that's what it's at stake in these cases. Needless to say, death always arrives, no matter what attitude one takes. Fighting might be honorable. Submission might be too. Either way, it is essential to die with dignity, just as it is crucial to live with dignity. Dignity might mean fighting to the end, or stopping a treatment, knowing when to say enough. Dignity isn't what the beast wants, but it is what all compassionate creatures want, no matter the cost. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series.
Our interns include Katie Chen, Antonella Dominguez, Delina Hadgu, and William Harvey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thanks for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.